At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's The Wonky Show. We talk about Westminster politics, the future of Data Futures, the Student Accommodation Survey, and a TV drama on essay mills. It's all coming up.
I mean, I think the other problem is that, I mean, at some point, you know, there's going to be an announcement of, let's say it's 7.5 grand fees or whatever it might be. You know, let's say that's 23, that's going to kick in 23, 24. There's going to be such a dip in 22, 23 as people delay the decision to go to university. I mean, how are universities going to deal with that?
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into higher education, policy, people and politics. I'm Rachel Firth and here to lift their one rep max of higher education policy. As usual, we have three awesome guests. In London, we have Gavin Conlon, partner at London Economics. Gavin, give us your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I'm going to give you a highlight and I'm going to give you a low light. So the highlight was the Chancellor's Spring Statement, so where there's a very big section in the OBR report talking about student loan accounting. So that was quite interesting. The low light, though, is the fact that economic growth has been revised downwards. And we modelled this yesterday, but essentially this adds about £400 million to the cost of the student loan book to the Exchequer. So that's the low light.
And hanging about at the start of time, we have Chris Shelley, Director of Student and Academic Services at the University of Greenwich. Chris, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, my highlight, Rachel, was all the great feedback we've had at this university following on from University Mental Health Day last week, where we launched our health and wellbeing strategy. We had a visit from Rugby World Cup star Matt Dawson, and we had dozens and dozens of events across the campuses. And it was just great to get a little bit of positivity around all the things that we're doing in HE to try and address the issue of mental health.
And from the Wonky Stable, Minding the Gap in Watford, we have Wonky's Associate Editor, Jim Dickinson. Jim, give us your highlight of the week, please.
Well, for me, it has to be the watching BBC Parliament when the vote was on ruling out a no-deal Brexit, which, given the kind of chaos, for me, resembled the final day of NUS National Conference when everyone is still drunk.
Right, this week, we kick off with the totally uneventful, bland and calm world of UK politics. We've had the Spring Statement, the Office for Budget Responsibility, or OBR, have given us an update, and we've had another meaningful vote on Brexit. So, Jim, what does all this mean, and what are the implications for HE?
What does this mean, and what are the implications?
Just a small question.
No idea. Now, no, lots has been going on this week, so let's try and do a little roundup. So, yeah, Spring Statement. Spring Statement's not a real proper fiscal event. It's a statement that kind of responds to the Office for Budget Responsibility's kind of assessment of where the economy is. But he normally gets to kind of tumble out a few goodies, and there were a very small number of goodies, announcements, and so on. So, what was relevant for the sector? He's brought forward the halving of the 10% fee that small businesses had to pay to take on apprentices to April the 1st. There was big concern, mainly in the FE sector, really, about when that was going to kick in, but he's brought that forward. PhD level occupations will be exempt from visa caps from this autumn, which is of interest to those that follow the kind of immigration stuff. There's new money for science and technology. He sort of said that an international education strategy is coming, although we sort of knew that. Lots of new numbers from the OBR on the implications of the ONS work on student loans, but I guess Gavin will have plenty to say about that in a minute. I guess for Augur watchers, the interesting bit was he name dropped the Augur review, said it would be published shortly, but obviously didn't say when. Now, Lots of other things that he talked about were essentially linked to the comprehensive spending review. So he did a few paragraphs on the CSR. And, you know, it's pretty clear now that, regardless of, to some extent, what Olga says, the response to it is what matters, and the response to it is lodged firmly inside the comprehensive spending review process. The one bit of interesting news that kind of vaguely relates to this that wasn't spring statement news is there are rumours today in the education press that Damien Hines was planning a series of HE interventions earlier on this week on some of the old press tropes around grade inflation and unconditional offers and so on that were somehow being linked to the Augur process. It was of interest that it would be Damien Hines rather than Chris Skidmore. There's a suggestion that Damien Hines wants to take back control of the kind of pre-Augur or responding to Augur agenda. But those interventions were pulled, so maybe those interventions will appear. The relationship between those interventions and the Office for Students isn't clear, and so on and so on.
I know this. I mean, it's not like the budgets of old when the Chancellor stands up, but I mean, there was some sort of interesting stuff in the spring statement. So, I mean, we're talking about the Augur review, and we're talking about what's the fiscal envelope that Augur can you know, operate within, and how Damien Hines is going to respond to that. But I think we have to think more fundamentally about the sort of long-term economic growth of the economy. So we're in a situation where the OBR have, you know, basically downgraded growth forecasts from something like 1.6% per annum to 1.2%. Now, it doesn't seem like much. 0.4 percentage points doesn't seem like much. But, you know, this is, you know, the fifth or sixth or seventh downgrading of economic growth. And this is sort of catastrophic, actually, for government finances. So if we look at things like the student loan book, as I said earlier, you know, you look at, because it's an income contingent loan repayment system, every percentage point reduction in graduate salaries basically adds about 900 million quid to the cost of the student loan book to the exchequer for every cohort. And these are sort of like, I mean, these are really serious numbers. So the 0.4 percentage point reduction in economic growth forecasted, if that feeds to graduate salaries, that adds about 413 million quid to the cost of the student loan book per cohort. So it's, you know, really dreadful stuff. There's other issues that he sort of didn't mention as well. And I think you have to look outside higher education a little bit. So one of the other big issues that's going on at the moment is, you know, the significantly reduced funding in schools and sixth form colleges. And this is a problem that's going to be, is being stored up for universities going forward and for higher education going forward. You see, you know, the cost rate is like, you know, approaching £4,000. It's gone down by 20-25% in real terms over the last 5-6 years. Sixth form colleges have basically eliminated any provision of modern foreign languages and any sort of wider activities from the school curriculum. And essentially, you know, the young people that are going to be entering to higher education in the coming years are going to be less prepared for university than they might have been a decade ago. And that's a real problem. It's also the case that there's going to be no supply of students into subject areas like French, German, modern foreign languages, etc. So it's, you know, it's dressed up, and it doesn't look so bad because of, you know, the absolute chaos that's happening in the back benches and everywhere else in Parliament. So a lot of that is lost, but there's some real warning signs yesterday.
One of the things that I think is really interesting is that when Damien Hines, for example, is ever invited on to news programmes, he will say a record amount of money is being spent on schools. To people who don't follow this very closely, that will seem odd if schools are complaining that head teachers are having to clean toilets and so on. And what that's really about is per head funding. So we know if there's a population growth coming in HE of 18-year-olds in 2 or 3 years' time, that therefore must have been hitting different levels of now secondary education for the past few years. And it's the per head funding and its distribution, of course, that therefore makes the real difference. Now, why is that of particular relevance to higher education? Well, Alison Wolfe, who of course is on the Augur panel, she did the first of one of three lectures a couple of weeks ago at King's, and it was originally scheduled to be post-Augur, but of course we're now pre-Augur, so I suspect some of the slides had to be rewritten. But the killer slide for me was an international comparison of the unit of resource, the total amount spent per full-time student, and of all the competitors, it's only the US that spends more. So it is hard to predict anything other than, whilst there might be some discussion about, you know, minimum grade thresholds and qualification reform and so on, I suspect that it's the unit of resource they will come for. And it's the unit of resource that the Treasury probably, on balance, given everything else, thinks is too high. And that, I think, is where the nexus of the row between the sector, government, Augur and so on will be in the next few months, because, you know, the settled view in government is that universities are profligate and probably could, you know, teach undergraduates on less money per head.
I think universities have got a real problem ahead on this. I think if the fee is cut to 7.5 grand, there's no top up in teaching grant. I think it's going to be sort of pretty catastrophic for them, given that everything else is going on, given the slowdown in China and the lack of ability to recruit international students, everything else. I think the Augur review could be really, really challenging.
And all we want is just clarity. We just want, you know, we don't want it's coming soon or shortly or imminently or potentially or whatever. We just want Augur to report. We want to know what's happening next, because it's really difficult to plan for the future without knowing the answers to those questions that you've just highlighted, Gavin.
I mean, I think the other problem is that, I mean, at some point, you know, there's going to be an announcement of, let's say it's 7.5 grand fees or whatever it might be. You know, let's say that's 23, that's going to kick in 23, 24. There's going to be such a dip in 22, 23 as people delay the decision to go to university. I mean, how are universities going to deal with that?
Chris, we've got a really interesting piece on Wonky at the moment about the representative body for universities UK. And with all this incredible things that are going on at the moment in the at Westminster and in UK politics, do you think universities are making a good enough case for themselves and really getting them, you know, forcing themselves into the debate, you know, pushing their agenda forward? Are we doing a good job of that?
Well, I think what you're talking about there is Anthony Seldon's piece this morning, which he's written for HEPI, highlighting exactly those questions, really. Is the sector pushing itself forward enough? Is our reputation among the general public what it should be at this stage? And Anthony argues no, and that a large reason for that is that the representative body, Universities UK, needs to sort of up its game, really. I think he makes a couple of valid points in this piece. Something that he says is he finds it sad how little we tend to talk about education. The kind of press around higher education seems to talk about an awful lot of things, whether it's VC pay, whether it's students' value for money, whether it's mental health, or whether it's accommodation costs, whatever it might be. But very little actually about, and simply on the educational experience, the quality of education, I think he's got a valid point there, that we aren't stating that point strongly enough. The pure value of higher education is somehow being lost in everything else that's going on. And I think he makes some interesting suggestions about how Universities UK could strengthen its arm.
One final thing, though, in the spring statement. His little flourish that is of vague interest to us is Philip Hammond repeated the Scottish government thing from last August on period poverty, but there was a specific difference. So basically it's free sanitary products for young people in schools, colleges and universities in Scotland, but he very specifically did not use the word universities in the English version when Philip Hammond did the English version the other day. So the question will be whether universities themselves in the English system choose to put their hand in their pocket and match that pledge.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Helen Scott and I'm Executive Director of UHR, the Professional Association for HR Staff in British and Irish Universities. Our UHR article was published on International Women's Day, and it's about what universities can and should do to narrow or eliminate the gender pay gap, and why the pace of change is frustratingly slow, more silver tortoise than silver bullet. Universities have till the end of March to publish their annual gender pay gap data, and we don't expect to see much change since last year, and that's frustrating. It's about culture change from the top down and the bottom up, not just HR policies and procedures. We've got some top tips for what's worked in some universities and case studies, including suggesting that all roles be advertised part-time with the option to go full-time, and abandoning unnecessary requirements for qualifications for jobs that don't really need them. Targets that focus the mind and doing the right thing should be the prime motivator. We're all human beings and we want equality of opportunity for everyone.
I'm Jonathan Mickey. I'm Professor of Innovation and Knowledge Exchange at the University of Oxford, where I'm President of Kellogg College, which is a graduate college where the majority of students are studying part-time. That's the only college in Oxford that's true of. And I also direct the university's continuing education as part-time degrees, online courses, summer schools, lectures to the public, and so on. My piece is about the need for continuing education, lifelong learning, adult learning, and picking up on the point that this coming November will be 100 years since the report on adult education published in November 1919. And we've established a centenary commission on adult education that I'm co-secretary of, which will aim to publish a report this coming November, 100 years on the current need for adult education, which is every bit as important as it was 100 years ago. And interestingly, the main arguments made in that 1919 report still hold true today. Great challenges ahead of us, they said, same today. New technologies on the horizon, same today. And the importance of electors being able to tell the difference between genuine political arguments and demagoguery, same today.
Next up, the news that data futures will not be going live in 2019-20. With the briefing email which was circulated stating there are a number of technical challenges to resolve. So, Gavin, can you tell us more about this one?
Okay, so data futures is it's a data collection exercise by HESA, and essentially it's meant to be a real-time data collection exercise, real-time in inverted commas, because what it does, instead of essentially waiting till the end of the academic year and collecting all the information on essentially students, and then publishing in retrospect, it's going to be a real-time analysis or data collection exercise. It's going to combine the main student data record, AP record, and ITT, initial teacher training record. And it's going to take place in a staggered way across the academic year. So it's meant to be a resource for the sector, which is much needed, but it's also meant to be a resource for the Office for Students. Sort of like acting as a dashboard or an advanced warning system that might help them to identify potentially if any particular higher education provider gets into trouble. So it's been stopped because of technical challenges. So it's not quite, you know, seaborne ferries and not having ferries. It's not quite a catastrophic decision to implement the data futures and then sort of row back on that. They've decided to basically pause the implementation of data futures for an undefined period of time. Now, the question is first of all, why did this happen? I mean, what are the technical challenges that made the steering group decide that they were not going to go ahead with the decision to proceed? I mean, maybe, Chris, you've got a better idea. You work in the sector.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we've been discussing around data futures in our institution, and I'm sure everyone else has as well for quite a while. The alpha and then briefly beta pilots have taken place, and certainly difficulties have been identified in those as to just how complex it is to gather all the relevant data. I mean, look, no one disagrees, I don't think, that this is a good thing. Ultimately, it is far better for the sector, it's far better for institutions that we have access to more real-time data, that we are more efficient with our data, that we are confident that we are gathering everything in the best and swiftest possible way that will help us plan, help us respond, etc. All of these are very good things. No one has ever questioned, I don't think, the ultimate goal. But institutions are the large, complex, in many ways old-fashioned organisations with various different ways of collecting data, lots of different pockets of practice around institutions within different faculties and schools and different campuses. There's a huge amount of data that goes on that exists within an institution, and it's very, very difficult for some institutions to actually be able to gather all of that, to change systems and processes, to get them up to speed, to be able to report in real time. Not only because some of the things that will be needed to report in data futures actually really need to be collected right at the very start of the cycle. So if you're talking about updating your online registration process and systems in order to gather this data, that is something that could take in itself a year to 18 months, and we need to be ready. So I think it's absolutely understandable and correct that there has been a delay, because I don't think the sector, and I don't think it's worth sort of pointing fingers as to, you know, who isn't ready. I don't think the sector as a whole is quite ready, both in terms of institutional data processing systems and HESA's own gathering of that data. We're just not simply ready to do this yet. And it is absolutely 100% important that when this is launched and when it happens, that it happens correctly. Because if it fails or if it's inaccurate, it will be flawed right from the very start.
But I've got a question then. I mean, most people would sort of say, listen, students turn up and you sort of collect the information on day one about these students. What's so complex about it? I mean, most people sort of can, you know, it's counting things. So what is the level of information that you have to collect that makes it so challenging?
Well, I mean, the problem is there are so many different levels of data and so many different areas of data collection. So, yeah, when students register, there is, you know, would be a single point of registration where you can gather certain amounts of information and a certain amount of data. From then on, there are a huge number of branches to the student journey, physically and in data terms, that mean that data is all over the place. It's gathered in different ways, it's collected in different ways, it's monitored in different ways, and various institutions are just at different levels. Look, you know, from my own personal institution's point of view, I think we'd have been ready. We're very good, actually. We've got some really good data management processes in here, but that isn't the case for everyone. And this was always going to be a very, very big and difficult technical challenge for the sector. And I wouldn't necessarily expect everyone to understand why that is. And I often don't myself, but it's so important that we do it at the right time and not try to rush it through.
So how delayed will it be?
Well, I think at this stage, I guess the hint is that will be a sort of a 12-month delay. There's no point delaying by 3 to 6 months or whatever, because you're talking about a data cycle. So really, 1920 was the initial target. I assume that they're now looking, how can we get this ready for 2021? I don't know that, but that's an assumption. The important thing now is, I think, that the HESA board and the steering group work with institutions to, you know, identify what is a realistic goal and agree what that is and then publish it. And hopefully we'll be able to stick to it. The next question really, I think, is what happens, what does this really mean for the OFS, who, of course, we're relying on this data, and that's a question for them to answer, probably.
But the thing is, for the OFS, I mean, it would be a very handy resource for the OFS, but I mean, obviously, and good quality data about the status of different institutions is always useful, but, you know, there's enough leading indicators out there that's going to give a very strong steer as to, you know, the sort of financial health of the sector. Or particular institutions. I mean, you'll be able to find this out from like applications and acceptances at a sort of very early stage about what the financial prospects of each institution are, surely.
Yeah, well, of course, I think, I mean, HESA is an interesting body, isn't it? So there's a designated quality body, as if there could have been anyone else in Britain that could have done the QAA's job, but nevertheless, bodies were invited to apply to be the designated quality body. And then similarly over in Statsland, anyone was invited to apply to be the designated sort of numbers and counting body, which, of course, in the end ended up being HESA. And that matters because that means that a really big kind of customer of HESA's work is OFS. Now, my understanding, and I suspect there's all sorts of people that will know more about this out in the sector, specifically working in that kind of sub-community of data, know more about this than me. But my understanding is that to some extent, there's a tension here between the sector itself being a customer of data futures, simplifying, standardizing data that is then of use to the sector in its decision-making, and the OFS as a kind of big customer because HESA is the designated, I can't remember the phrase, the designated data body, yeah. And there is a sense from lots of the data professionals, certainly on Twitter, that it is the kind of big bad regulator that has come in with all sorts of requirements that to some extent has kind of put some spanners in the works. I'm not sure how true that is. I suspect that, although, of course, if it's running at full pelt, OFS does need lots of the bits and bobs that data futures would produce. I suspect that Gavin's kind of right that if the OFS in year two, and remember, it, you know, hasn't even finished doing the initial registration batch yet. I suspect in year two, OFS will be okay about using the kind of numbers that are out there already on the old systems that Hefke had. It will be if this becomes a problem again. So if these problems somehow become compounded and there isn't, you know, we're not ready in a year's time, that's when things, I think, will start to get really tricky.
Yeah, I was going to say, listen, there's two things about this. I think It's very rare that in public policy or when a decision is made that when additional information comes through to cease a project or to delay a project that actually ever takes place. So many times in public policy, you know, the politicians and the government departments just plow on regardless. And you can think of, you know, a million policies like this. So it's actually really encouraging that somebody sort of, you know, had the guts to actually sort of, despite the optics in terms of this looks bad and it hasn't been implemented on time, somebody had the guts to actually sort of hit the pause button because in the past, you know, you could have seen this sort of carry on. The data would have been a bag of spanners. You would have had a discontinuity in the data, and therefore all analysis of trends in higher education would cease to exist. The negative, though, about this is I think the pause might open up a discussion on items that have been previously agreed about on data futures, about sort of definitional issues and things like this. So, it might be just picking at a scab in some respects.
Now, no hidden history this week because we've launched a thing. With more detail, here is Wonky's Editor-in-Chief and CEO, Mark Leach.
Hi, I'm Mark Leach, founder, Editor-in-Chief and CEO of Wonky. And I'm absolutely thrilled to be introducing Wonky SUs this week. At Wonky, we're a real fan of the UK's unique student union sector. I started my career in higher education by representing students in my students' union, and many of the team here have similar stories to tell. Student unions tend to get a bad press nationally, but away from the student politics headlines, the day-to-day contribution that SU's officers and staff make to higher education policy and decision-making, both locally and nationally, is vital, where co-production with students is a defining and celebrated component of our system. Right now, most of us in the sector will be all too aware that it's SU election season, as hundreds of students put themselves and their ideas for improvement forward. With faith in representative democracy at an all-time low in wider society, we ought to be thrilled that in UK higher education, there's a thriving tradition of student democracy that generates ideas, feedback, challenge, and keeps decision makers on their toes. But representing students and contributing to policy effectively has never been easy. But in comparison to when I started out, it has become really tough. Higher education policy is complex, confusing, and constantly changing. We sometimes take for granted just how impenetrable the sector's language and structures are for anyone, let alone those that have just been elected and won't have the luxury of a year to bed in. We know that SU officers and staff that understand the environment and the issues are more effective, get more done, and make a bigger contribution to the life of our sector. And given Wonky is all about finding and promoting diverse voices and helping to improve higher education policymaking, we want to help. So for a small fee, student unions will be able to subscribe to Wonky SUs. We will produce policy briefings and beginner's guides on key issues in higher education, and a bespoke weekly news service for SUs featuring the latest developments, news coverage, analysis, and opportunity for student unions, as well as access to a dedicated discussion group. And full subscribers will be able to take advantage of training, take part in dedicated interactive webinars on key issues that SUs will be discussing with institutions, and will be able to access the team at Wonky with questions and queries. If you think any of that sounds useful, email sus@wonky.com. And if you work in a university and you think your student union would benefit from a bit of Wonky, please let them know we're doing this.
Next up, the 2019 National Student Accommodation Survey. Commenting on the responses of over 2,000 students, the report states that many students feel overwhelmed by the cost of housing and that most students borrow money to pay for their accommodation. Chris, can you tell us more about this, please?
Well, yes, this is a survey conducted by Save the Student, who are a student money advice website, and they've canvassed the opinions of over 2,000 students about their experience of accommodation, and it includes some interesting results. Some of the information is about their cost and about sort of bits about data and quantitative, but actually I think the really rich information is in the qualitative feedback and the interest, the experiences of students, especially in the private sector of accommodation. So look, the opinion of 2,000 students is very valid. 2,000 is a lot of people, and that's why I think their experiences are very worth looking at. This is 2,000 out of 2.5 million, so quite how much we can learn from the actual cost analysis that the survey presents, I'm not sure. But certainly the things that are presented about their experience are quite eye-opening. The top 10 biggest problems that students say that they experience, the top two are noisy housemates and housemates stealing food. So their biggest problems that students have is actually other students. I mean, perhaps the stealing food is just them preparing for a post-Brexit apocalypse, but it's certainly... interesting that their own behaviours are a problem. But some really worrying things there. 35% of students have experienced damp, 32% lack of water, 20% disruptive building work, and then other things, 16% rodents and pests. And I think, this raises some interesting questions. Of course, universities' own accommodation is a university's problem, and I certainly would hope that we aren't well, we're certainly doing our best to provide water and heating and prevent rodents in our own accommodation. But once students go out into the private sector and start finding their own accommodation, there's a question there about how much of that is our responsibility, how much is it for us to help and advise and guide students through the experience of navigating their way through, you know, a commercial sector, dealing with rogue landlords or even good landlords, paying their bills, doing the appropriate budgeting. And I think this flags that, you know, there's a huge part of a student's experience which has a big potential to impact on their academic experience. 63% of the students in the survey said they felt the cost of accommodation negatively impacted their mental health, and that was a rise of 45% from just last year. More than 80% said they want their rent capped in line with student finance. So I think it is, you know, in our interest as universities to know and understand what the experience of students is in their accommodation, because it has such an impact on their day-to-day lives. And when what the survey flagged is more than half of students said that, well, their maintenance loan doesn't even cover their rent, that immediately says, well, more than half the students have got to go out and work, or they've got to go out and borrow money. And that puts an extra strain on them financially and socially and academically. So this is something that we should all be listening to, not least, of course, because we know the OFS have said that they want to start focusing on accommodation costs. The very prominence of this kind of survey, I mean, yesterday, given everything that was happening yesterday, this story at one point yesterday was the second story on the BBC website. So this is of interest to people, and the sector needs to be ready to respond and to support our students as they experience this. I just one thing to just a flag. I think a couple of weeks ago you had Pete Quinn on and discussed the experience of students and accommodation, and he flagged then lots of us are trying to, you know, we're introducing guarantor schemes, we're linking up with citizens advice bureaus, we're trying to connect ourselves better to students and connect our students better to the advice and the support that they can have that can minimize their financial pressures and hopefully improve their experience.
But the problem is any of this, like, you know, I mean, this is all sort of dreadful stuff. You know, 20% of young people live in, you know, in rat-infested or sort of with rodents and things like this. I mean, this is horrible, clearly. But it's the exact same for young people or young graduates in the private rented market. I mean, you know, this, I mean, one bit I read in the report is that on average it takes something like a month for the landlord to respond to particular queries or complaints and things like this. But all this represents a wider policy failure. I mean, you know, it used to be the case that people lived in sort of cheap private accommodation 20, 30 years ago. But all because of the lack of house building fundamentally across the economy, all the sort of what used to be traditional student housing has been basically snapped up by, you know, if they're lucky enough, by young people. And that means that the, you know, students in private privately rented properties are sort of getting even lower quality, you know, rentals. And it's just a lack of, you know, a lack of government investment, surely.
Yeah, I mean, I think the policy failure here is extraordinary on all sorts of levels. I mean, the first thing I'd say is whenever reports like this come out, what you don't see is a comment from the housing minister, and you don't see a comment from the higher education minister. And I suspect that's because they think it's each other's problem. But if you think about the concerns of students and the concerns of parents, that stat you did about, or when someone said just now, you know, this at one point was the, you know, second most popular item on BBC News. There's a reason for that. It's massively important to people. But because it's a subset of this wider housing crisis, that is a really wicked, difficult policy problem. I don't think anyone thinks it's their problem. And, you know, I mean, you only have to look at Sam Gyimah's Sam on Campus tour. Every single time he turned up on a campus, people would raise the cost and quality of student accommodation, but yet I can't remember him ever saying anything about accommodation other than promising that DfE were looking at it at Wonkfest, and then nothing coming of the promise. So the lack of any kind of consideration or policy response, I think, is really interesting and highly problematic. What is causing it? I mean, of course, this is a subset of the wider housing crisis. Me and DK have started to have a look. We haven't got anything hugely robust at this point, but on the site a couple of weeks ago, we published something where we started to have a look at the concentration of students that are in all sorts of urban areas. You know, the growth of the sector must have caused more students to move into those areas. We know that graduates, to some extent, will stick around in urban areas and so on. That must be a decent hypothesis that is pushing the that is making the kind of cost of housing and the housing shortage worse. That means costs go up and so on. And that leads to a couple of things. Either it leads to rogue landlords generating the sort of student experience that that NUS's survey a few weeks ago describes. And or it also leads to this kind of gold rush to throw up purpose-built student accommodation, some of which is of excellent quality but quite expensive, some of which is of terrible quality but quite expensive. And the policy question there is it okay that lots of foreign investors are generating 15-20% yields out of what we think is student maintenance spend? I'm just not sure that we wanted to do that as a country when we, you know, lifted the number caps 4 or 5 years ago. So this is a really thorny, wicked problem. It relates to the boarding school model of HE. We've got to think about this in terms of that kind of growth in 18-year-olds that will hit us in the next decade. It relates to the size of institutions, but it can't go on. At some point, something has to change here, because even if Olga was to turn around and say, here's another 20%, on, you know, maintenance loans, the cost of accommodation is shooting up faster.
Well, I think this is one of the problems. I mean, you talk about the maintenance loan. I mean, I think part of the acceleration in the price of student accommodation has been a result of the availability of maintenance loans. And private landlords aren't stupid. They know what essentially the budget constraint of young people might be, given the fact they have maintenance loans. And I think they've essentially captured that. One other point I was going to say, you know, for the Diamond Review of Higher Education in Wales a couple of years ago, one of the points that was put into the final report was that because of this increased availability of maintenance grants and maintenance loans for university accommodation, there was going to be a track. Basically, the cost of accommodation was going to be tracked to make sure that universities didn't gouge the eyes out of students. So, and they were pretty strong on that. So there are ways of stopping, you know, universities from hiking prices. Private landlords, what can you do? It's a free market, unfortunately.
Commanding the full confidence of HE data people everywhere, welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? This week, we are looking at non-continuation, specifically the number of students who dropped out of HE entirely in 2017-18 and the number of students who transferred to another provider, from last week's HESA data. Do some providers tend to see students leave HE, whereas others see transfers, or does it correlate?
So I would like to think that there's an inverse correlation here, because when we're supporting students who are considering withdrawal, one of the options we would present to them would be, well, have you considered transferring to another HE provider? So I'd like to think that as we increase the number of students who are going to other providers, we're decreasing those who are dropping out of HE overall.
I'll play anyway. I mean, I don't know. I would have thought that if you plotted these on axes, I would say that there's no correlation, because a dropout is a flow in one direction. A transfer, it can work both ways. Presumably, institutions would receive students and lose students to other universities. So it's it should be net-net zero on average. So you would imagine it's not correlated.
The answer is yes, it does. With R squared at 0.74, this is one of the strongest correlations we've seen so far. Roughly twice as many students are likely to drop out of any given institution as those who transfer. More students, that's 250, transfer from Middlesex University than any other, and more students leave HE entirely, that's 570, from Leeds Beckett. As always, the graph is on the site, and I've used size to show the overall student numbers in each institution. Remember, with data protection in mind, HESA rounds these values to the nearest 5, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
And finally, SA Mills made a rather public appearance this week, being featured in ITV's drama Cheat. The programme features a student who uses an SA Mill, and we've seen one of these companies providing research to the student site, The Tab. So, Jim, are these companies gaining prominence and credibility, and should we be worried about that?
Well, I mean, it's been quite a cheaty week this week. So before I actually answer your question, Rachel, I mean, the big US story around higher education this week has been parents cheating their kids' way into HE through some sort of big scam. That story's been quite hard to avoid because it involves celebrities and things. So, I mean, that's worth a look. We don't have a similar problem in the UK, but of course, we do in theory have this problem with SA Mills. Now, I always think it's fascinating when higher education is represented in popular culture. There are always some tropes. So they always feature really, really old buildings. It's really hard to find a student being taught in a brand new building in popular culture's version of English HE, whereas, of course, in reality, there are tons of new buildings. But in episode one the other night, and this is broadly a kind of psychodrama around that involves sex and murder, like every other ITV1 drama. But the backdrop and mechanic to kind of make this work was a student suspected of plagiarising their dissertation. Now, there were some obvious problems insofar as there didn't appear to be any second marking of this dissertation, and it didn't appear to have been submitted to Turnitin. The academic themselves, that part of the plot device was that the academic wasn't a permanent academic, but appeared to have an office the size of a small branch of Morrison's. but nevertheless... Nevertheless, it's really interesting to see this stuff in there, and some of the kind of moral questions of, you know, academics that are supervising students, their relationship with students in a kind of supervisory sense, particularly when they then suspect them of cheating. They may not manifest in, you know, sex and murder, but some of the issues it raises about some of the issues it raises about those relationships is really interesting. Well, one aside, by the way, I think it was this week that it was announced that Turnitin had been sold for over $1 billion. Of course, the scandal there is that I'm not convinced that when students enrolled in institutions and, you know, their essays were all uploaded to Turnitin, they knew that one day their intellectual property would make someone else that amount of profit. Because Turnitin is, of course, has its value in this vast database of previous students' work. But anyway, nevertheless, fascinating to see, you know, cheating and the relationship between academics and students kind of highlighted in this way.
I mean, my hot take on this is essay mills are bad. I mean, they are difficult for us to intercept, if you like. They operate around social media with all sorts of. I mean, I think Jim, I've seen you testing their bots on Twitter before by simply using the some keywords, and a bot comes in and offers you the service of an essay mill. But they also operate. They pay students to hang outside our libraries and just try and listen out for students who are on cigarette breaks talking about their, you know, how difficult it, and they sidle up to them and say, "Well, actually, I can get you help with that." It's really difficult for us to police.
You're
this kind
kidding?
Of stuff. No, we've had that report. So, you know, it's what we really need, and it's flagged in the Wonky Daily today. Pinsent Masons have penned a piece saying, look, it's legislation is overdue. We need something to help us in this area because, you know, Turnitin actually for us is a hugely important tool. It's a very valuable tool for, I'm not surprised by the kind of price tag because they've sort of got a monopoly on this particular, you know, function of higher education, and it's really useful for us to be able to use that as a plagiarism tool. But we need legislation to help us with the essay mills because they're really difficult to monitor.
I think the other problem, I mean, I always think about this. We did a piece of work a couple of years ago for Ofqual, and essentially we did some mystery shopping of essay mill sites. And of course, you know, it's on, you know, all the essay mill sites that sort of guarantee, you know, A grades or whatever it might have been. And essentially they were independently marked, blind marked, and the grades came in as E's and F's. I mean, it was, you know, the standard of the work that is done by these SMLs. I mean, forget about the morality or the legality of it. I mean, the standard of the work is just, you know, shocking and appalling. And, you know, I don't know. It's just such a shame that, it's got to the stage that students don't. They think that it's an easier way out is to pay for an essay rather than putting in a couple of days' work.
Yeah, I mean, just to say, there's a terrific piece up on the site today from Phil Pilkington. He's doing this kind of series of narratives for us on higher education that looks at some of the kind of wider issues, both on kind of how you regulate this and the morality of it all. I won't spoil it. I will recommend it, but I should just read his final paragraph, really, that kind of sets some of it in context, I think. So he says, look, if we were to be limited to the crude material conditions of tuition fees and debt on graduation, some poor assessment practices and worse feedback, the anxiety of gaining employment, finding affordable housing, a career possibility, the dangers facing the UK economy, the spectre of racist populism across Europe, and all the other things we know face students, we shouldn't be surprised that so many students are cheating. Perhaps we should be surprised that so few are. And I think there's something interesting in there about the, you know, where the stakes are at cheating, how easy it is to cheat now, and the kind of, to some extent, moralizing approach that we use, encouraging students not to cheat, and whether or not actually we'd be much better off spending all of our time focused on designing new, innovative, interesting forms of assessment that aren't write an essay.
So that is about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. So search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or find the feed that you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, do drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Gavin and to Chris and to Jim, everyone at Team Wonky for making this happen. And until next week, stay cheaty.